Welcome to Dome Theory. Sports, culture, a little bit of everything. Documentaries coming soon. We're on iTunes, we're on Spotify, Stitcher, many different platforms, YouTube. The Music Monday we put up on YouTube, Taylor had some copyright claims, so that's falling a little behind. I'm going to have to pull out some of the music in there. I think it was the Riot beat and the button song that you put at the end got claimed. So it's no problem on the podcast side, but YouTube, there's some issues there. I put up a little visual on Instagram, so you guys can check that out. And today, we're going to be talking to Jeff Perlman, one of my favorite guests. We talked to him about his Brett Favre book, my freshman year. He was one of the first guests on this show, actually. And then we talked to him about the USFL book before that came out. So I actually wanted to get into a few notes from that book. Really fun book, Taylor. I think you should check it out. There's some Trump in there because he owned the New Jersey Generals. There's just a gazillion hilarious stories. One of my favorite books I've ever read. Like Jeff's a pretty funny writer, but this content just made it 10 times funnier.
Yeah, I mean, there's the 30 for 30 on the USFL Small Potatoes, and that was good. So I might have to give it a shot. You know, it's quarantine. I don't have much else going on. So
the Jordan documentary is next week too. A lot of people are excited
Sunday
about
night.
That.
Bomani's
doing,
night.
Bomani's doing a book club on Jordan rules, so I'm going to pick that up and get into that book. I'm excited for it. I know there's going to be a censored version, an uncensored version. This is Sunday night at this point. Wow, time is just flying. I'm all in. I'm 100% all in. The Dennis Rodman documentary was awesome that ESPN did, and I just want to learn more about Jordan.
Yeah, I mean, I just can't wait for something to look forward to. Like, you know, we always have, you know, a couple times a year we have a Sunday night. Last year it's Game of Thrones. Maybe it's a TV show. Maybe it's a, you know, sporting event. But Sunday night appointment television on Twitter is always electric, and I can't wait.
I know. We get.
And this is a documentary, the first two episodes of a 10-part documentary. And I'm excited like it's, you know, like Celtics Lakers in the finals.
No, they're doing one and then they're waiting like weeks to do number two though, aren't they? We really needed
it. No, it's two episodes. It's two episodes every Sunday for 5 weeks.
Straight?
I think so.
Oh, okay. So this is better than I thought it was. We also might have sports coming back. Have you heard that? Here they come.
There's no need to rush this. It's so important that people stay safe. It's so important that the healthcare professionals and system isn't overwhelmed even more than it already has been because we're stupid.
Well,
you know what I mean?
Mark Cuban came on TV as joyful as can be. He's been appointed part of the staff that Trump has put together to reopen the economy. And it's the WWE head. It's Adam Silver. It's Rob Manfred and all these sports heads. They're going to be opening the doors far and wide to get this thing rolling on May 1st, which is now 2 weeks away. Get ready, Taylor. Everything's going to be back to normal. Baseball, it's going to be on our TVs. We're going to be wicked excited for baseball, as we always are.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll have to drive down to Boston, go to Fenway with you the second quarantine's lifted, so we can go hang out with a couple thousand people and get sick.
I hate to do this because I actually do want sports back. I want to watch the NBA playoffs. I think the playoffs
that's
be
what
starting
I missed
right
the most.
Around now.
I was seeing highlights of, you know, old playoff games. I've been watching highlights of old playoff games on YouTube and just going through stuff. I think it's 2 years ago today was game one of Celtics Bucks, the series the Celtics won.
That's
so, like,
right. Yes. Here. Today's actually 2 years since I ran the marathon, and that was the day before. And I'll never forget that because I was eating like a huge bucket of rice to get ready.
Yeah, no. So I was there for that. So, you know, that's what I miss. I think NBA playoffs is definitely what I miss the most. Being a LeBron fan, being a Celtics fan, there's just a lot for me to be excited about, you know, amongst a lot of other things. So I do miss the playoffs. It's unfortunate that we don't know exactly what's going to happen, but like I said, I think it's most important for like safety at this point.
We've been on board for a long time that this is probably done. It seems like the league's going in that direction, but now it's just the mixed signals out of Washington and at the top of these sports leagues and baseball, especially throwing out like four different ideas at this point, just makes your head spin every day. So there's really not that much to talk about on that front. We'll get to it as it continues to develop, but again, it looks like they're pushing hard at the highest level to get sports back into May, which I don't know. I'm not an expert. Fauci said it's possible if they're quarantined. He is the expert. There's another professional at Beth Israel who's talked to 98.5 who says this bubble idea is a possibility if it works right and they have the right amount of testing. So I'm not going to rule it out entirely. It just seems a little premature to me. Maybe this is something we look at in June. Cuomo was talking about different treatments that might surprise us in the near future. I don't know, but right this very moment, it doesn't seem like there's enough momentum on the medical side to actually get sports out there. And again, like you said, are sports really the priority right now? Like, does the economy reopening committee need to be sports leagues just because Trump's mad that he's watching 14-year-old games on TV? But he's also working very hard.
I mean, there's something to be said for, like, the economic impact of sports. Obviously, if you're playing without fans, it's going to be much less, I'd assume. But I don't know. I think I want sports for something to do. That's my thing. Is like, I mean, how many nights, you know, whether it's, you know, me and you at school or whatever, like, is it just all you do is watch basketball? You start watching, like, you know, the game at 7, and then your team comes on at like 7:30, and then you watch a West Coast game. You know what I mean? Like, that's every single night. And so it's like been finding other things to do, which is, it just feels weird, especially now when it should be playoff time.
It is a strange feeling, and I miss like the opening minutes of a big game when the Celtics would really come out firing, like opening night this year against the Sixers, even though they went on to lose that game. They just came out like hammering. Hayward was hitting buckets in the early minutes. That like first few minutes of the game is what I miss most about sports. What's it for you?
Like, the honestly, I think it's just like it fills a lot of time. It fills a lot of time. Like every night, especially with basketball, a sport that's it's not like football where football is a couple nights a week. Basketball's every night. So it's just like there's always something. You know, if you're not going out, if you're not doing whatever, like there's always games on. So I think that's probably what I miss most.
We're about to talk to Jeff Perman about that, his upcoming book on Kobe and the Lakers. Not a ton of details out of that book yet. It comes out in September, but his interview with Shaq is something we got into. He did not interview Kobe before he passed away, but one of the most interesting things is how, as he was finishing up this book, how Kobe's death at the end of January changed the whole outlook of this book, what he expects the reception to be, because once this book comes out, Taylor, and there's going to be a whole documentary that comes out with this through Showtime, doesn't look great on Kobe. There's a lot of, from 96 to 03, there's a lot that happened around his life that we've talked about and gone over a million different times that really made him a very divisive character, and things changed toward the end of his life, but the focus of his book is that period in his life. So we'll see how it's received. Let's talk to Jeff. And we welcome to Dome Theory today none other than Jeff Perlman. Hello, Jeff. It's been a long time since we talked. I think the last time we talked, I want to say, was the Brett Favre book on the verge of the USFL book coming out. And I'll tell you, I got the USFL book on the Kindle while I was in Spain. Spain was the best ever because I had to ride the subway every day, so I could pretty much ride and read on my way to school and then ride and read on my way back. When you're driving, you can't do that unless you get the audiobooks, and that's not something I do yet. It's something I get coming up. And that book, it was just laugh out loud funny. Like,
I appreciate that.
Obviously you did a great job with it, but the league was just so ridiculous that like you didn't even need to like
be funny yourself. Like, the content itself was just so funny. The two things I think of out of it are Trump and the cheerleader uniforms, and the former player who tried to assassinate his coach, and they need a security detail. I'm trying to think of some other ones too. What was your favorite story looking back on that book now? Because like every single chapter was just so damn funny, right up until the disbanding of the league.
I mean, I really liked. I liked the fact that my son and I wound up having Stone Cold Creamery in a shopping mall with the guy who tried to kill his coach, which was a really highlight moment for me. Us walking around, because I didn't think I'd find him, and he kind of vanished, and we actually found him, and it's me and my 9-year-old kid, and the weird juxtaposition of us eating ice cream with this kind of psychotic football player was. I mean, I also like that a guy was put on the injured list for slamming his penis in a trunk. I think that's pretty good. You can't go wrong with that. There's some things you can't go wrong with. That would be one of them. Yeah, there were a lot. I mean, it was a very fun. Sometimes you write a book and it's really hard to get good information. And sometimes in a lot of ways, you get out of the way and you let the book take its course. And that's kind of what I did here.
You had a tough time tracking him down, didn't you?
Yeah, it was really hard. I found two addresses for him, but no phone numbers. And they're both in San Francisco. So my son and I, we live in Southern California. I took him on a road trip to San Francisco and we stayed with some friends. And we walked through like this really bad area of San Francisco and we're going under bridges and there's pee on the ground and broken glass. And we get to this house and he doesn't live there anymore. There's a lockbox. And then I went by myself to the second address. It was in the projects, not such a great area. And his sister, it turns out, lived at the address. And she said, well, give me your number and I'll see if I can get him to call you. And I get the next day, we drive off to Sacramento. He called me back 10 minutes later. And the next day we're in Sacramento at a food court eating ice cream. It was great.
I have to say, the blog's been a little slow lately. I know you're getting the book rolling and stuff like that. The tweets are rolling out there. I love interacting with you on Twitter. And the one thing I want to talk to you about, too, that you were tweeting about recently was the CNN Chiron going after Trump. And to tell you the truth, Jeff, you're able to keep up with this at a pace that I'm just not, which is funny too. We were talking before we went on here about me having the technology issues and you not so much. I can't do it anymore. Like, there was a point at which, probably around the time that your book came out, that I could do the Trump stuff every single day. And now I don't know if it's the quarantine or just him being on TV every single day for the hours that he is. I think that's what got me to the point where I'm just on overload now. And like even the CNN underscores that, I love to see it because I think I got to a point where I was like, the media needs to come back at him in a more aggressive way. And we had this conversation years ago about how the media should handle his attacks on them. And now we're seeing with these press conferences every single day where the amount of lies that are just rolling in at a rapid pace, the trouble that they have fact-checking him. And then I see these lower thirds that they're putting out there. And then on Monday, them actually just shutting it down. It's a very far step from the last time we talked. It's definitely a big reaction that some of these networks have taken. I wonder how you feel about the steps that they've taken now in the last couple of days to just kind of shut down these press conferences.
So I kind of view it this way. If these press conferences were strictly about coronavirus and there were updates from health professionals and then the president giving sort of talking about initiatives, I don't care that I absolutely despise Trump. I think you air those. That's important. But he's decided these are going to be his campaign rallies. And they've been about attacking the media. They've been filled with lies. They're just him spewing about nothing. And just because someone is the president doesn't mean you're required to air everything he says. You know, you're not at all. And I just think, if he wants to run these things as clown shows and efforts to get reelected and him just bashing people, I'm not saying the media needs to bash back. The best way to get back is just stop showing it. Like, just stop showing it. Report on the stuff he said that's important. And the other stuff, just ignore and cut away from it and maybe sum it up later on. But it's exasperating. It drives me crazy.
I was so stunned to see them go as far as to say propaganda session, like the adjustment that this band.
There was. He was right. They were right, though. That's the thing.
But they have done that in 2017, though.
No, but like, I actually feel like I didn't see anything CNN wrote that was untrue. Like, I actually didn't see anything they wrote that was untrue. It was propaganda. Propaganda, by definition, is giving false or misleading information and presenting it as fact in this case, in a governmental manner. Well, that's exactly what he was doing. There's no doubt about that. So if he's presenting you propaganda, call it propaganda. If he's lying, lying. If he says, talks about all these actions he took on China, and then you can look it up and see 2 months ago he was doing the exact opposite of what he's saying, write it. Like, that's how you report. To just allow this stuff to be out there and not fact check it at all, that's not journalism. That's factually not journalism. That is propaganda.
Well, there's your Trump minute. I got to do it when Jeff comes on. The quarantine for you, I think, you know, everybody's been doing, oh, I was quarantined, and doing the quarantine-related stories. Has it changed your life all that much?
I like not being at home, and I like doing things. But, you know, I have two kids. My kids are 16 and 13. They're great. They've handled it really well. They're independent. We kind of go about our days in different. I usually sit outside in the back. My wife is on the couch working. My daughter's in her chair, and my son is at the kitchen table, and they have homework, so they're doing that. I'm reporting a book. I'm not writing it yet, so I'm going through clips and digging through news articles, and I can do that whether I'm here or whether I'm at a Starbucks. The main thing is you just see so much suffering, and you see so much sadness toward. My wife and I, the San Antonio picture.
I know you saw that. Like, that was just gut wrenching. The food lines that they had down there.
It's preposterous. Or what about Wisconsin making people wait online to vote wearing masks when
you didn't have to? Pouring rain.
It's just so disturbing. So to me, when people are like, how's it going? Oh, it's going great. Like, it can't be that great because so many people are suffering and so many people are out of work and so are sick. So for me, it's been easy by compared to 99% of people, but it doesn't mean I'm happy about it or enjoying it or relishing it. I'm definitely not.
And there's the amount of judgment too. Like, everybody jumping to this position where they need to, you know, whether it's in the local Facebook groups or anything else, just trying to put a blame on somebody else for the situation that we're in. And I know you kind of have to criticize people when they're going out and hanging out with friends and stuff like that and playing basketball. If you remember the aerial shots that they had of the people playing basketball out on your neck of the woods there in California, and there's just this rush to judge and place blame on somebody for this. And it goes up at the top level, I feel like, you know, when we have the whole China situation that there is right now. But on that lower level too, where they're just blaming kids for being outside for the situation we're in and looking for someone to blame for this whole thing it's not great from a societal standpoint, I feel like, because, you know, this should be a time where you're stepping out, showing some sympathy for people. You know, you definitely want to educate people on what they should be doing, but there's just a whole lot of finger pointing going on that, I feel like.
So I agree and disagree. In an ideal world, we're all, you know, holding hands. Well, not holding hands, but we're all sort of working together. And
there is
no
some
politics.
Of that. There's been a lot of charity. And
there
stuff,
is
so I
a lot. Oh, yeah. Look at hospitals. I mean, the work has been amazing.
Yeah.
But I think two things. Number one, you have people like us who are busting our asses to keep our distance. We're not hanging out with other people. We're not letting our kids go hang with the neighbors because, hey, you have people who are working their asses off, people who deliver the mail, people who do jobs that need to be done, people who work construction, people who work at the post office, Amazon, whatever. And I feel like people taking unnecessary risks are kind of slapping the faces of people who have to work. And who have to. I mean, there was a, I don't know if you saw this, there was a bus driver in Detroit a couple of weeks ago, and he put out a post on his Facebook page that went kind of viral about some woman on his bus coughing and coughing and coughing and not covering. And
that was brutal.
A couple weeks later, he died of coronavirus, the bus driver. So it's hard for me to be just like, hey, it's okay. Or when I see like my, you know, I just, when I see stuff, it's hard for me to be like, don't worry about it. Don't worry. Be happy. Like, I think now is the time. I am angry when I see people not taking precautions. And I am angry when people are cavalier about things, when they walk into a store without a mask and then they walk up to the clerk who's wearing a mask. It's not fair to those people. So there are things that I would admit, kind of frustrated about.
For sure. And we've seen some of these stories now that are really hammering home just how deadly this is. If no one believed how deadly and serious this was at this point. I mean, at every single level, you have one of Trump's best friends dying. You have Carl Anthony Towns' mother dying from this. And whether it's food workers, Amazon workers, and all that stuff, like it is shocking to see just how many different levels of society that it's hitting. And, you know, especially people who are out of work, people who are forced to go into work, especially at the grocery stores. That's the one that hits me. You see these big runs on the grocery stores, and it's just like, oh my Lord. Like, imagine if, like, you were 16 and you actually have to go out there and make some money, and you're placed between making some money and going in there and doing this thing. There was one manager who, in New Hampshire, rallied a bunch of people, customers outside of the store, and he was just telling these people to their face how they got to act, the space they need to do. Like, he was just, like, marching out orders. I don't know if you saw this video, but that was one of the better videos I'd seen of this guy directing the customers and pretty much telling them how they have to act to keep his employees safe. Because in the grocery stores, I think, like, it's ground zero of this. We saw it from the very beginning. The amount of people that are rushing in and out of there every day to get surprised. I think it's calmed down a little bit, but that's where the biggest rush was early on.
Also, like, the video, you saw the video of the person going to, I don't remember what store it was, and loading up on the toilet paper, like, putting, you know, tons and tons of toilet paper on her truck and driving off. And I just, it brings out the good and it brings out the bad. And there's a lot, like, I buy the toilet paper we need. You know, I buy the toilet paper we need. I'm not going to load up on a million things of toilet paper because other people need it too. And I'm no more valuable than you or anybody else who needs it. So when you see things like that, it's exasperating. And then on the other side, when you see the people working in the hospitals, not having the proper protection, making masks on their own, showing up day after day, knowing the risk, having kids at home, but still busting their ass to save people, it's inspiring. So I just wish we had a president truly who could not make this about politics at all, who could just want the best for the people, who wasn't thinking about re-election, who wasn't insulting people. I saw a video today, just today, Trump had someone involved with the virus in the White House, in the whatever, the Situation Room or whatever it is. And he's saying, I shouldn't say this, but I imagine you're not going to vote for Sleepy Joe. She's not going to vote for Sleepy Joe. I don't think she. And it's like, buddy, like, people are dying. This isn't about you. This isn't about your re-election. Just be a freaking leader. Have empathy. Have heart. But as you saw in my US of L book, I honestly just think he's incapable of that. And I really feel like that corrodes all the way down. I do.
It's the hypothetical we talked about during the election of, is, if there's a crisis, can there be some calm, stable level of leadership? And it's almost like it's stunning that it actually played out and that we actually have a situation that tested that theory to a T. And, you know, the people who support him will say the bluntness is part of the appeal and everything like that. But I tend to agree with you and say just having someone up there who would say the right thing and calm people down to some degree is a major, major part of the job. But, you know, I don't want to circle back to Trump too much. I do want to get to your former employer, Sports Illustrated, because this is another thing. There's a lot of stuff bumming everybody out, especially people my age. I mean, we've had to deal with graduation getting canceled this year and, you know, half of the semester getting cut off in our last semester of school, and just these relative things that you try not to pout over too much because you see what a disaster other people are going through, but do kind of hit you inside to some degree. Seeing SI just, and this has been a multi-year thing, but I know this has to hurt you too to some degree, being that you worked there when it was such a great publication. And we talked about on a couple episodes that we did ago, the trips that you got to used to take to Florida for spring training, the house that you got to rent down there, just all those great stories that you have from your time there that frankly don't exist and aren't even close to a reality for the people who work there now. Instead, it's people wondering if they're going to keep their jobs. 40 staff members let go at the beginning of the year, 6 more recently, and then this whole situation with Grant Wall, who accused SI that they were trying to do a permanent pay cut for him. The company went back and said that he was making too much money. But the statement that they threw at him was just like, you talk about looking right from a position of leadership. Everyone that is but one person, they say. That person made $350,000, so they're throwing a salary out there last year to infrequently write stories that generated little meaningful viewership or revenue. How far of a cry is this from the Sports Illustrated you know?
I mean, it's not even the same. It has a name, Sports Illustrated, on it, and some of the people work there. Some really, really good people work there. Good in both talent and just decency. But I always say when I got hired at Sports Illustrated in 1996, joining the dream team, it was joining the dream sports. It was everything you could imagine, and all the perks that came with it, from a huge expense account to athletes taking time to, oh, Sports Illustrated's in town, 100%, what can I do? Everything you could imagine. Seeing your name in print, magazine, 3 million subscribers. It was magic. It truly was magic. And now I'd be shocked if the print magazine exists a year from now. I'd probably be shocked if it survives the pandemic. The people in charge of it, the Maven people, they don't care. It's just a thing for them. It's not entirely their fault. It's been a long downhill fall. They never adjusted to the web in a smart way. But it's, I mean, Grant, I came up with Grant. Grant John Wertheim and I came up the ladder together step by step by step. I've known Grant since 1996. He's a great writer. He's a great reporter. He worked his ass off. He made a lot of money because he'd been there a long time and he was really good. I think it's okay to, I guess it's okay. You can make the argument it's okay to fire somebody, in that way, to throw their salary out there and throw them under the bus after all those, you know, decades, 2.5 decades of service to that magazine. Was just really classless and really despicable. And it was a bunch of asshole motherfuckers trying to, having being tone deaf and trying to make themselves sound righteous when they were not.
It's unbelievable. And the Ringer just posted an article about some of the stuff that's gone on in them, whether it's hiring a 17-year-old high school student and then going back and having to drop him off. A complaint from the New York Post that they used an interview. Like it was just such a great publication. I said this in class a semester ago when we were talking about different publications and doing projects on them. It's somewhere where I would have dreamed of working, and now I look at it and say that's somewhere I never want to work. Which is like that. It's just tough to think about because you had two great sports magazines, them ESPN the magazine, which is completely dead now. Is there any sports magazine left to look up to, really?
Print wise, no. And it's interesting. Like I would say a year ago, I was talking to someone who was at Sports Illustrated and they were debating whether to take a job at The Athletic, right? Athletic was offering a job. They were debating whether to take it. And it was a real debate. It was like a real, real debate. And nowadays that wouldn't be a debate at all. You would leave in 2 seconds. Ship is sinking. Like you see it happening. And it sucks. Like you become numb to it because it's been happening for a while now. And then you remember, oh wait, this was a place where I dreamed of working that I read throughout my childhood. I mean, I could take you upstairs to my office right now and you'd see under my couch, like a futon, you pull out the drawer and there's probably 300 issues of Sports Illustrated, back issues of SI that I still read when I'm like, last night I couldn't sleep. I grabbed an old SI. And so that to me was the Bible of sports writing and everything I wanted it to be. It sucks.
10 years ago, it was still decent. Like I still have the pile from the 2010s and the late 2000s, and you obviously have them going back decades before that. Like you really don't have to look back all that far to see when it was still a very, very quality publication that you'd love to subscribe to. I want to get into this discussion, and there's not a whole lot of discussion around sports these days. It's definitely ramped up to some degree with the draft and some of the other stories that have fizzled out since then. But this hunger for sports to come back, it's expected, given that we all love sports, that we want to see them back on the air. Like it's very strange to just look at ESPN and see them doing reruns at the rate that they are. Like they seem to just have their head spinning as to what to do still a month later. But every single day, it seems like one of the lead stories is hope to get sports back, plans to get sports back on the field in the very, very near future. And baseball, obviously, is chief among them. They'd be in the midst of their season right now. I hear the Arizona plan first, and I think, all right, like I guess in perfect conditions that could work. And then I hear the Japan one roll out like a day later, and I'm just like, all right, we're just spitballing at this point. And there's been like two plans since then is how baseball is going to come back. Separate sites in Florida and Arizona. It's good conversation. It's hope. So I don't want to crush on hope, but I think that's something we're meant to do when we're as bent up about facts and reality as much as we are, is look at ideas and hope that people have and just say, is that realistic? And that's what I've been doing a lot of since the start, and I hate doing it because it's anti-fun, and it hurts me too to think that we're not going to have sports for a long time. But how do you react to some of these plans that we're seeing to get sports back on the field, whether empty stadiums, quarantining people to a state? Like, it's just so far out there that I'm like, do we even want this?
I mean, I think that the hunger for sports is so real that people would take anything. I really do. That's why so many people are watching reruns of games they've seen before, because we you know, there's a real hunger for it. I miss the – I mean, I love taking my son. My son, Emmett, is 13. I love going to – we live 15 minutes from Angel Stadium. And I love the sounds of baseball, the smells of baseball, two broadcasters talking about players I've never heard of. Just – I love that, and I miss that, you know. But I just think everything is very hypothetical until we know whether it's safe. Like, it's just all so hypothetical. It's so hypothetical. I just think it's hypothetical. I think it would be great, but it has to be safe right now. There's no central sort of understanding of where it's going to be safe, where it's not. So if you said to me, do I think baseball is going to return this season? I go 50-50. In some form with empty stadiums in Arizona and Florida. But I think there's just as good a chance the season just doesn't exist.
I just see a situation where you get into the midst of it, and then we know so little about this still that there's still questions over whether you can contract it and then come back with immunity. There's questions about how contagious it is still to this degree. Like, I read an article today about, like, is 6 feet really the right distance? Like, it might be even further than that. It just doesn't seem that realistic all that much to me to even imagine fans in the stadium in the NFL in the fall. And that's something we're not even talking about right now. The NFL the whole time has just been like, oh, we're good. That's so far in the distant future. It's like when Jeff Perlman's book comes out, like, it's going to be good.
Thank you. I think that one thing that I've realized from this all, we spend so much time talking about sports, and talking about sports has become bigger than sports themselves in a lot of ways. Free agency, the draft, potential matchups, trades. Like, the talk is so much, you know, NFL Network, MLB Network, talk, NBA Network, talk. And sometimes it's easy to forget how valuable the games are, you know, because so much is about debating who's better, Brady or Peyton Manning, or who's did the Le'Veon Bell, blah, 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 and all this stuff. And I do think, for me at least, maybe for no one else, this has been a reminder how the most enjoyable part about sports is actually a game. Sitting down in front of a game, sitting in the stands at a game, having a hot dog and a soda with your kid, sitting in the sunshine at Petco, wherever. I just think it's a real reminder. Like, there's only so much we can say about sports right now. We talked enough about – I don't need to talk again about the NFL draft ever again. I don't need to know about the Oakland A's minor league prospects. I don't need to know about the 10 best Cy Young Award candidates. Like, I just want a fucking game to be played, you know? Sorry.
So you're in a position now where you're able to you're starting on your next book. You got the LA Lakers book done. I wonder how you would have handled this as a regular staff writer. Say you were at the Tennessean, say you were at Newsday, SI, any one of those spots, and all of a sudden there's no sports left. High school sports are gone. College sports are gone. You're without the games, as you talked about. How would you have handled this time?
I think a few things I would have done. Number one, I think if I were a beat writer for a team, or if I, let's say I'm the Seattle Times, right? I think I would pick the Seattle Mariners' best season or most memorable season and either rerun the articles day by day as if that season is going on, or have your beat writer write, watch the games on TV and write about it, or involve former players and interview them every day. Like, I just think nostalgia is the thing you got to key on as much as you can. People do love nostalgia. It's a magical thing in sports. So I also think I'd be writing a ton about – I'd be doing daily online interviews with the whatever. If I were covering the Yankees, I'd get Don Mattingly one day. I'd get Jeter the next day. I'd get Hensley Mullins the next day, day after day. I would just talk to old Yankees about their favorite memories. I'd talk to prospects. I'd make it a lot about the future. Make a point every day to do a profile of a different prospect. Anything you can do to sort of touch on the two main things that drive sports, which is nostalgia and hope.
It is a great time for access, isn't it? You said you're working on the next book. Is the availability just so much better than it's ever been?
I haven't been calling people yet. I've actually just been spending my days through newspaper archives, but I will soon. And I got to think the answer is yes. I mean, we're all home, right? We're all home. What else is there to do?
You just got
to talk to me? Great. I'll talk.
You got to do this thing, which is, do you like being in person better than this? Like, that's something I've always felt.
Yeah. Yes. 100,000%. But, I mean, you make do with what you can. And most of my interviews are done via phone. I can't afford to fly everywhere, you know, so. But the big ones, I'm kind of holding on and hopefully, you know, just do what I do.
We were actually for a little bit until some contractual stuff got in the way. We were simulating the rest of the Celtics season here on CLNS and having the announcers do it as it would have been called. And we were putting together a broadcast. So, like, the creativity of this time has been really fun to look at and just see how not only, like, culturally people are getting by through social media and stuff like that and this whole TikTok thing. I don't know how you feel about the TikTok thing. That's not so much my speed, even though I love music. But it is a really interesting time to analyze how everybody's dealing with it and eventually look back on it and just be like, wow, that was the craziest thing in the world. Because you really can't compare this to anything. Like, you know, you've lived through 9/11. That was like a week where time stood still. You know, people lived through, everyone's talking about Pearl Harbor. Like, anyone remembers Pearl Harbor, but whatever, throw it in there. It's insane. Like, who knows? I've lived the craziest 4 years ever these last 4 years. So who knows? The rest of my life might just be batshit insane. That's how it's looking like it's going to be right now. Whether it's college starting with the Trump election and now this to cap off college. But I don't know. There's going to be an insane time to look back on.
I think you'll be looking back. I always tell my kids that their grandkids will be asking them what 2020 was like. You know, did you live through the coronavirus? They'll be reading about it in textbooks. They'll be reading about Donald Trump. And what I'm hoping, what I'm truly hoping, and I'm somewhat optimistic about, is it'll just be this batshit crazy period in history. And they'll be like, what was it like with Donald Trump? And they'll be like, oh, mom and dad, my parents were so upset about that, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And he was a disaster. But then we elected Joe Biden and it kind of, you know, blah, blah, blah. And coronavirus, we figured it out. And then we developed a way to, you know, an immunity and blah, blah, blah. But I just think it's the same way I would talk to my parents about what it was like when Kennedy was assassinated. What was that like? Or I talked to my grandparents about the Holocaust. What was that like? We all have these periods in history. I thought mine was going to be 9/11. I really thought 9/11 was going to be the defining period of my life as far as that moment. And I would say this is right there. If it hasn't exceeded it, I mean, I'm a New Yorker and I was there in New York, but this has come very close if it hasn't exceeded it to the just like, is this really happening thing.
You talk about the year, and now as we get into Kobe Bryant here and the Lakers book you're working on, the year that started for the NBA, especially with Kobe Bryant dying, which was just like eyes shoot up, like you don't even know how to react to that news when January rolls through, February goes by, and then the whole entire league shut down by March. The league has just gone through so much this year. And then you even go back to the whole China situation that they went through at the very beginning with Daryl Morey and how big of a story that was around the league. It's been an insane year for the NBA. And like your book that you were working on, you're finalizing, January comes around. And just like everybody else, I think it was January 28th, I want to say, right around that date, right at the end of January. Everybody's sitting around. It was very early your time, early afternoon, East time. And you see the TMZ tweet. For some reason, I'm always looking at my phone when that TMZ tweet comes through, whatever it is. And 1 minute ago, Kobe Bryant died. And you're double checking it. You're looking at every single website looking for the follow up because who believes TMZ, even though they've been right about a lot of the stuff. And then the slow realization creeps in that he's actually dead. And you were finishing up that book. You had studied his life. Yeah. Did you interview him?
No, I got Shaq. I got Phil. I got probably about 300 people. I was told early on he would be impossible to get, and he was impossible to get.
So. All right. So you don't run into Kobe in this, but you run into everybody around him pretty much. And then you're wrapping up this book, and Kobe Bryant's dead. You have so much of it written, and you really can't even integrate that into the book at this point. And it was 96-03 anyway that you're focusing on. But like, how does that play through to you as someone who's just so engulfed in his life at that time?
It was awful. I mean, it was awful for basketball fans everywhere. So it's not like it was awful though. I mean, the book was done. I was sitting in a corner bakery in Irvine, California, and a friend of mine texted me and said, Kobe Bryant died. I think Kobe Bryant died, something like that. And I just it doesn't make sense. You know, it's kind of like 9/11. I mean, it's not 9/11, obviously, but that feeling, that first feeling where you're like, this doesn't make sense. This doesn't make sense. And, you know, it's weird because he doesn't come off that great in the book in a lot of ways. You know, it was a very developmental time in his life. There was 96 to 04. You had the rape accusation in Eagle, Colorado. He was kind of a pain in the ass as a teammate. He was very difficult. A lot of teammates didn't like him. And all of a sudden you're like, I have this book coming out, you know, after you get over the process of death, I have this book coming out and I don't know how this is. I don't know, you know, like this isn't going to come out great. So what I ended up doing is, and I really meant it sincerely, is I wrote a new sort of note from the writer at the beginning of the book, just about sort of placing the context that this was a period of Kobe's life of growth and who he would become, but it's not the full story of Kobe Bryant. And I think it's important to make that clear, that the guy who later became a dad of four and a girls basketball coach and an Academy Award winner wasn't that guy during that period. It was a different period in his life. So that's what I did.
Are you expecting a storm come September 29th that week?
I'm not. I'm really not. I don't know. I mean, I no longer know what to expect in this world. Like, period. I don't know what to expect in this world. So I don't know. I think if you look back, I wrote a book on Walter Payton years ago, and the backlash to that was fierce because an excerpt came out in Sports Illustrated about 3 weeks before the book came out. And there was an excerpt that concerned his infidelities and his depression later in life. And a lot of people thought I was writing a book to destroy Walter Payton. But the book wasn't out yet. It had 3 weeks till the book came out. So there was a lot of negativity about that. And I got a lot of crap from that. I feel like I'm a much more mature sort of person than writers from then. I feel like I know how to hopefully handle these things a little better. So
the timing is just insane that your book is pretty much going to be the first. And it's not exclusively Kobe. It's as much Shaq and it's as much Phil Jackson. It's as much the whole situation there as it is Kobe. But like, this is going to be the first like Kobe release, the life of Kobe, a look into the life of Kobe when it comes out, which is really going to be interesting. And I'm excited for it. I was excited for it before. This definitely raises some of the intrigue. But that was such an interesting period in his life. You mentioned the rape accusation at the end of that stretch there. And even just the, you know, tumultuousness with which he came into the league. The guy falls almost out of the lottery because he's coming out of high school. You know, Michael Cooper works him out, that legendary workout. We have Michael Cooper here on the network, so it's going to be interesting to hear from him to look back on that workout that he had coming into the league too. As a figure, what were some of your major takeaways actually really diving into the life of Kobe at that time? And, you know, what was the most interesting thing you learned about him through your reporting research?
All right, so here's the thing. I'm going to be honest. I can't talk that much about it because my publisher will kill me. I'm just being honest because the book doesn't come out until September, and they hate when you do that. I can tell you, though, but I respect the ask. I mean, he's a complicated guy, you know? This is where I think I took away about Kobe that kind of I find really fascinating. If you look at Kobe in 1996, 97, if you just looked at him, right? He looked really, really cool. Like, he just looked really cool. He was a good-looking guy. He had the cool haircut. He was a Laker. He took Brandy, a popular singer at the time, to his high school prom. He dressed really well. But he really was kind of a lost lamb. Like, he wasn't cool. He was nervous and awkward and uncomfortable in his own skin. And he was a kid who was raised in Italy, but an African-American kid raised in Italy who sort of walked into a world of, you know, hip-hop and culture and shit talk. And it wasn't really his world. He wasn't brought up in that world. So it was weird. Like, people had – he was in the same draft with Allen Iverson and Steph Marbury. And people almost, like, expected him to be that kind of guy because that's who you were back then. Baggy clothes and Iverson with the cornrows and a lot of tattoos and you know, kind of that thing. I mean, Steph Marbury's from Coney Island and Marbury's from Newport News, Virginia, tough places to grow up. And Kobe wasn't. Kobe was a suburban kid from Italy. And I just think one thing that really fascinated about him was this adjustment. And if you look at him in those early years, he was always mimicking Michael Jordan. licking the lips, the way he talked, the cadence, the way he carried himself on the court, studying his moves, studying his shots. And it was like he needed to copy this thing because he wasn't an individual at that point. And I feel like the guy you saw after he retired was a much, much more comfortable human being than the guy who was a star for the Lakers in his prime.
How does your experience doing this book compare to the first Showtime book you did with the Magic team and those cast of characters there?
It was harder because it was more recent. And modern athletes, they make a lot more money, which causes a certain level of entitlement and a certain level of expectations. So those 80s Lakers were just easy to find, easy to locate. A lot of them were doing blue-collar jobs or were still working in certain fields because they didn't make that much money. The guys now, and they made a lot of money. The guys I talked to were great and awesome, but it was harder. So, and also, like, the 80s were my money period for nostalgia. Like, the Magic Bird matchups were, for me, were bliss, were absolute bliss. And the Shaq-Kobe era, I was a working journalist. So that sense of wonder that I brought with me to Showtime, I didn't have here. Now, what I did have here were three of the best characters I've ever written about, Shaq, Kobe, and Phil. They were just fantastic. I mean, you know, Shaq was so much more interesting and embraceable character than Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was. Magic was more embraceable than Kobe, but no more interesting. And Phil Jackson and Pat Riley were both fascinating power figures of the dynamic. So it was, in that regard, it was really interesting. It was just hard. It was a hard book.
The feud between Shaq and Kobe was sort of simmering toward the end of Kobe's life. That's not the right word. Cooling down toward the end of Kobe's life. And then everybody saw the emotion that it hit Shaq with after he died and the speech at the ceremony that they had and the TNT segment where he was breaking down and the regret that he had over it. You obviously talked to him before all of that. I wonder how that plays out in your head because you get this perspective from Shaq on Kobe before the death, and now Shaq obviously has this whole renewed vantage point of Kobe after death, and a lot of people do in general. Like, that's pretty much the lens everyone's going to be looking at this book through. What was that Shaq interview like? How does that play on your head that, you know, Shaq's going to have these two different visions now?
I mean, I think it's like when a classmate from high school dies who you had a mixed relationship with. And when the person dies, you just are overcome by the fact that this person, even though you didn't always like him, that he had a profound place in your life. You know, there was a guy I went to high school with who was a real bully to me. And later on in life, we became friends. We're not great friends, but we're friends on Facebook. He made my high school life miserable, you know? And if he died tomorrow, I would be really devastated because I would feel like it was this piece of my life that is gone. And I feel like it's just, you know, you don't, when you think of Shaq, the first guy you think of is Kobe. When you think of Kobe, the first guy you think of is Shaq. There's a brotherhood in that. Even if it was not a natural brotherhood, even if Kobe never allowed Shaq to be the big brother Shaq wanted to be, there still was a bond, a life eternal bond between the two of them that came from playing together, winning, being this two-headed monster. So I think the devastation you saw from him was real. And I'm guessing it probably caught him by surprise a little bit, the level of despair and sadness he felt. Because, I mean, they had a really difficult relationship when they were playing together. But they were also kids. You know, you get older and you have perspective and you realize that the shit we went through together, it wasn't who we were at 26 isn't who we are in our 40s. We're just different people.
What was the candor of the interview that you had with him?
He was great. He was great. He's a delight. He's just a bundle. That guy is joy personified. he is. I always say, my wife and I talk about this. People in this world, celebrities in this world, like Muhammad Ali used to be the guy who made everyone feel good. Muhammad Ali was that guy. Who, black, white, conservative, liberal, Christian, Muslim, Jewish, no religion. You see Muhammad Ali in the airport. He does this to you. You have that experience. You feel good about yourself. Muhammad Ali is no longer alive. Who are the people who have that now? Magic Johnson, Snoop Dogg, Dolly Parton, and Shaq. That's our list of four. Something about Shaq that people just love, and he has this big kid thing about him and this embraceable one to hug. It's a magical, magical thing that just owns and understands. When he walked out of the Staples Center and he had everyone quiet and they start getting chant Kobe, Kobe, not many people could do that. Not many people could actually have that happen. It was him personified.
I'm trying to think of who I'd add to that list. David Ortiz pops into my head, but that's only Boston.
Not universal. Not universal, but somehow or another, like Snoop Dogg. I mean, it's really amazing. Snoop Dogg, who used to be a gangster rapper when I was growing up, has become this like embraceable, lovable guy.
Had a murder Shaq. Case.
Murder was a case that it gave him. I mean, Shaq is loved by everyone. He's just loved by everyone. There's nobody who doesn't love Shaquille O'Neal.
The Kobe's not a great example because you had ardent Kobe lovers and people who just couldn't stand Kobe. And there was like no in between on him. But there was a like universal level of respect, I feel like, that he achieved toward the end of his life, which is incredible too, because a lot of these people who do gain that level of admiration weren't that way earlier in their lives. I mean, Shaq left the Magic and really pissed a lot of people off when that happened. And, you know, you had people on both sides of that feud. It is interesting to see how people can transform to divisive or controversial figures into just universally beloved.
Well, it's different also. Like, all right, Shaq left the Orlando Magic. People in Orlando were pissed off. At the end of the day, it's just sports. Like, it's just sports. Yeah. You know, he left, played somewhere else. He seems like a nice guy. It's like David Ortiz shows up in New York now. He's greeted with love and warmth because it was just baseball. At the end of the day, it's just baseball. Like, it's not life or death. And I think, Kobe did not have the natural warmth of Shaq. He was engaging and he was smart and he was sophisticated and he was savvy. But did he have a natural sort of light in the way that Shaq did? I don't think so.
What was your favorite interview you did for the book?
I would say Phil Jackson. I got 8 hours with Phil Jackson in Montana, and that was awesome. It was like I could see people betting on, bidding on a raffle, win a day with Phil Jackson. We drove around a lake. We had lunch. We went back to his house. Then we had dinner. It was great. It was a magical day for me.
I'm going to keep picking. What did you get?
I can't say. Yeah. I can't do it, man. I respect it, but like my publisher will kill me.
That's a smart strategy of interviewing someone months before the book comes out.
Yeah.
So you'll be back. You'll be back here at some point. It's always a joy, Jeff. You said you're getting ready on another book, research and everything else. I haven't heard what it is. Have you put it out there yet? No.
Nope. Not. All right. I cannot say. You'll be the first to know.
Thank you.
Hey.
He's Jeff Perlman. You know where he's at on Twitter. You know his website, jeffperlman.com. Three Ring Circus is out September 29th, 2020. Jeff, always a blast. Can't wait to talk to you again.